Sai Ram from Prashanti Nilayam. Dear listeners, Radio Sai continues its weekly presentation of the talking book version of Mr. Howard Moffat's highly acclaimed book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. The author was among the very early Westerners who came to Satya Sai Baba as a skeptic in 1964, and drawn by his enigma, he stayed for considerable periods of time near him in the next 6 years. During this period, he conducted extensive research and probing investigations into the Sai phenomena. He published his findings as the book that has become a classic of Sai literature, often considered the primer which introduced Sri Satya Sai Baba to millions round the world. This book was first published in 1971. Since then, it has been instrumental in drawing millions of seekers to the loving path of Satya Sai. These readings, dear listeners, are being aired every week, and if you wish to revisit a chapter at any time, you can do so at our website radiosai.org. So dear listeners, welcome now to Sai Baba, Man of Miracles by Howard Moffat.
Sai Ram, and welcome to this talking book session of excerpts from Mr. Howard Moffat's book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. Higher and nobler than all ordinary ones are another set of teachers, the avatars of Ishwara. They are the teachers of all teachers, the highest manifestations of God through men. With those profound and prophetic words from Swami Vivekananda, Mr. Howard Moffat starts off the final chapter of his book, which has served as a primer for millions of seekers in their spiritual quest, drawing them to Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. Chapter 20 is aptly titled Avatar. As we navigate through the culmination of the book, Mr. Moffat's message and thoughts here invoke reflections on God and avatars, as the Hindu philosophy knows of it. Who is an avatar? What are the qualifications for this title? Is Sai Baba an avatar? Are there any other avatars? These are some of the questions that Mr. Moffat seeks to answer in today's session.
When I discovered on my first visit to Prashanti Nilayam that most of Sai Baba's devotees spoke of him as an avatar, I began to inquire and read all I could find on this Indian doctrine of divine incarnations. Actually, of course, it is not an exclusively Indian doctrine. Christianity teaches that Jesus, the carpenter of Nazareth, was an incarnation from the triune Godhead. But it states that this was the only divine incarnation, a unique event in the long history of man on the earth. Hinduism, or the Sanatana Dharma, and Mahayana Buddhism, on the other hand, teach the more reasonable doctrine that there have been many incarnations on earth from the Godhead. In its simplest, most elementary form, this Hindu doctrine means that Vishnu, that member of the triune Godhead concerned with the maintenance and evolution of the universe, takes human birth. Narayana, another name for Vishnu, in his all-pervading mode, is considered the origin or seed of the avatars. The Srimad Bhagavata states the truth of the avatar principle in allegorical language in its first book, the Purusha, that is, the first person or God, known by the name of Narayana, is perceived by the yogis as possessing thousands of heads, of eyes, of arms, of feet, etc., and is the seed of all avatars. On the same subject it states, as countless rivers are born from an ocean that never goes dry, so countless are the descents of the Lord. Some of these are major, like Rama, Krishna, etc., but most are minor amshas, rays from His supreme radiance. So according to this teaching, there are degrees of avatarhood, and many of the great spiritual teachers of India are believed to have embodied rays of the divine radiance and to have been partial or minor avatars. The few, the teachers of teachers, those who have brought about a great forward movement in man's spiritual evolution are called the major avatars.
But how shall we understand this question in its deeper metaphysical sense?
According to the truth, religion, that is, the wisdom at the foundation of all the great religions, every human being is a descent of the divine into matter. But as well as being a descent from God, man also represents an ascent from lower forms of life. Because of the immortal divine spirit that has come into him, man has struggled upward along the path of spiritual evolution and will continue to ascend until he fully understands and realizes himself to be of nature divine, or to put it another way, until he is merged with God and knows himself to be merged. The end of his long journey of many lifetimes through the phenomenal worlds of matter will be to arrive where he started, as T.S. Eliot says, but to know the place where he is and who he is for the first time. Changing the metaphor, the divine seed will have become a fully grown plant. So man is at present a meeting point of the animal and the divine. As he climbs upward from the mud and the mire, the higher light descends into him, inspiring and aiding his climb. All men, as well as being sons of earth, are sons of God, as Christ said. But when an individual has reached the end of the pilgrimage and washed away the dust of earth in the cool kingdoms of celestial dew, what then? There will be no desires to draw him back to earth, no karma, no unfinished business to drag him back. If he returns, if he reincarnates, it will be because of his love of mankind, his desire to help his fellow men in their titanic struggle. Great compassion can be the only motive for the descent of one who has reached the enlightenment freedom, divinity. We must keep in mind that one who has lived as man and finally and fully realized himself as God merges with the divine ground of all being, the Godhead. He becomes, in mythological terms, part of the myriad eyes and hands and feet of Narayana. If he incarnates as a human being once more on earth, surely this is God incarnating, for the freed soul and God are one. The metaphysicist may try to draw a distinction between the divine man and the divine in man, the descent and the ascent. But when a highly intellectual devotee of Baba questioned him on this point, Baba said that there is no real difference that you can call it ascent or descent, because both are involved and both are true. The fact is that our finite minds cannot really grasp this deep, abstruse question. All we can understand is that a major avatar, though man in appearance, human in body, is totally God within.
That brings us to the moot question of what then are the signs and signals by which we can know an avatar?
What are the signs and signals by which we may know a major avatar? The most obvious are, of course, the siddhis, the supernatural powers. Being completely merged with God, he will have command of all of these without the use of mantra, tantra, or yantra. He will have, for instance, the power of creating anything on the spot from the akasha, that is, from apparently nothing and nowhere. The same power enables him to increase or diminish quantities and sizes as required, and to cause objects to vanish or change their nature. Important points to note are that, with an avatar as distinct from a magician, these siddhis do not disappear or decrease no matter how much they are used, and they are never used for personal gain, always to bring blessings and benefits on others or to glorify God. Another major avataric sign is the power of bestowing divine grace. Sai Baba says that such grace is really a reward for good things done in the past, perhaps in a past life. It is like personal savings that have been fixed in the karmic bank and are suddenly released by the power of the avatar. We don't remember the good deeds, the causes, and so the windfall is regarded as a gift from heaven. But Baba says there is also special grace. This has nothing to do with past good actions. There are no assets in the karmic bank in which you can draw, but you desperately need some funds. A rich man with understanding and compassion may go guarantor for you, and the bank will advance you the money. Special grace is something like this, and the avatar has the power to bestow it. It may come as a result of one's repentance and self-surrender to God, and is thus similar to redemption. Special grace may change a person's fate, and so also may its opposite, the power to allay dooms. By the laws of karma or moral compensation, all men will suffer sooner or later for their errors and misdeeds. But if the crimes are very great, the avatar may hasten and concentrate the karmic effects by laying a doom. Thus, Lord Krishna put the doom of prolonged wandering with physical and spiritual suffering on Ashwatthama, the killer of infants and sleepers. If the avatar shows anger, it will be righteous anger to overcome evil and promote human welfare. Behind it will be the sweetening leaven of love. The surface personality may sometimes show human emotions, but behind them is the constant bliss of one who lives in the eternal. From the eternal heights, beyond Maya or illusion, where his center always is in full consciousness, the avatar sees the past, present and future. Untrammeled by restrictions of time and space, he perceives causes and effects far beyond our human vision and judges accordingly. Therefore, his words and actions are often hard to understand. They may seem puzzling sometimes, even unreasonable to ordinary humans who see only a small portion of life's great tapestry. So we say that the avatar is inscrutable. These then are some of the outer signs by which men with perception may recognize the God in human form. Minor avatars possessing perhaps a few of such features come fairly frequently, particularly in India. Several have lived and taught during the last 100 years, for example. The great avatars, on contrary, are rare. Many centuries elapse between their advents.
But what brings these great avatars to earth?
They come only when conditions on earth have reached a critical stage, when there is grave danger of the evil, demonic or backward-pulling forces overpowering the good, devic or forward-pulling forces. They come as a drastic medicine to destroy the evil toxins in humanity and give a spurt to the evolution of human consciousness. In the oft-quoted verse of the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna, speaking as God himself, says, "Whenever virtue subsides and wickedness prevails, I manifest myself to establish virtue. To destroy evil, to save the good, I come from age to age." There is no doubt that we are living today in an age of great crisis. The world is the body of God, Baba says. There is a cancer in the body and it must be removed. Can the cancer be treated or must it be removed by drastic surgery? That is the question. In other words, must there be a catastrophic war, an Armageddon, before mankind, what will be left of it, learns to live in brotherhood and peace? Or will a gentler therapy be effective? Long ago, Lord Krishna, both heavenly avatar and earthly king, strove first for peace. But he found in the end that the surgery of war was necessary to remove the cancer of that day, a powerful military caste that had grown arrogant and evil and forgotten its dharma. Many centuries earlier, Avatar Rama was forced to deal with the same problem in the same way. He had to fight to destroy the Rakshasas, the demons in human form, who were dominating the earth and obstructing the divine plan of human evolution. What about today, with the human race riding the precipice of nuclear doom, with ignorance and greed sharing the reins? Can the powers of light take over direction in time? Baba uses a different metaphor. White ants are in the tree again. In ancient times, the tree was cut down. Now, we try to save it, so perhaps there is hope.
But why should an avatar be necessary? The religious-minded man may ask. If the direct intervention of God is essential, why can't he act from where he is? Why must he incarnate? Sai Baba once said, "A person wishing to save a man from drowning must first jump into the same pool. The Lord must come here in human form to be understood by men."
In taking on human form, we should note the Divine One takes on certain human features and limitations. He has a physical body to which, as Swami says, he must pay the taxes. If we study the lives of known avatars such as Rama and Christ, we find evidence of some emotional attributes that are more human than divine. Sorrow, anxiety, partiality towards certain people, for example. We may be surprised to find these human touches in the personality of the incarnated God, but actually they bring him closer to us. Through them, we are able to understand him a little, and so come to the divine qualities beyond the human. Hence it is by becoming a human being with some of its imperfections that an avatar is able to promote human welfare. Concerning his mission in the world, Baba has said many things. Here are just two of them. I have come in order to repair the ancient highway leading man to God. Become sincere, skillful engineers, overseers and workmen and join me. The Vedas, the Upanishads and the Shastras are the road I refer to. I have come to reveal them and revive them. And also, I came to sow the seeds of faith in religion and God. You might have heard some people say that I became Sai Baba when a scorpion stung me. Well, I challenge any of you to get stung by a scorpion and transform yourselves into Sai Babas. No, the scorpion had nothing to do with it. In fact, there was no scorpion at all. I came in response to the prayers of sages, saints and seekers for the restoration of Dharma. Practically, all the close devotees of Baba, especially those who have known him for a number of years, regard him as undoubtedly a major avatar. Their personal experiences, their deeper feelings and insights have convinced them of this. Some people, like Dr. K. M. Munshi, sense the divinity of Baba at the first contact. Writing in his journal, soon after his initial interview with Baba, Dr. Munshi said, "The true test of a God-possessed individual is whether he has the capacity to plant the seed of faith in men, a seed which when it blossoms will liberate them from greed, hate and fear. This quality Baba has in abundant measure." People from the West, as well as the Indians, see Baba as a divine incarnation. After her first visit to Prashantinilayam, a woman of Germany, a devout and earnest seeker on the path, said, "Baba is the incarnation of purity and love." Later, after spending more time with him, she wrote in a letter, "I get more and more convinced from within that he is Jesus Christ who has come again in the fullness of Christ as Satya Sai Baba."
But then if Swami indeed is an avatar, why do not all men and women regard him as one? Why do some people see him as a mere holy person with supernormal powers?
Some people, however, who have visited Baba and seen him as a holy man with supernormal powers, do not regard him as an incarnation of divinity. But this has ever been the way of the world. Most of Krishna's contemporaries saw him only as a man. Even some of the great yogis of the time seem to have doubted his avatarhood. Only a few saw his infinite splendor and knew beyond doubt what he was. The same seems to have been true of Rama. And how many accepted Christ as of the high Godhead when his sandals trod the dust of Palestine? Even some of his disciples were not convinced. But when one spends days and weeks with Sai Baba, be it in the special atmosphere of the ashram or on tour in many places, one soon begins to feel that he is far beyond the measurements of man. Apart from the miracles which show his command of nature, his power to be anywhere and know what his devotees are thinking and doing. "I am a radio and can tune into your wave," he says. And his ability to bring protection and help, apart from all these superhuman qualities, there is the pure egoless love. This above all stands as a sign of a Christ-like divinity. In man, sometimes we see flashes of this love shown towards children, the sick, the weak. In Baba, it is there all the time, flowing freely from the divine fount of his nature, embracing everybody collectively and individually. And this love is backed by a great wisdom, a deep intuitive perception that sees the real beyond the play of shadows. His devotees have countless proofs that Baba sees their past, present and future, that he knows their karma and what suffering they must go through to pay old debts and learn the deeper truths of life to reach deliverance. And he helps them to bear that suffering when its immediate removal is not expedient. He becomes the kind, gentle, indulgent mother and the courageous, compassionate, merciful father until his children's hearts and eyes overflow with bhakti tears. They wonder, "What have I done to deserve this? Surely I am not worthy." If we were asked to list the attributes in our concept of God, the spiritual parent, most of us would name these: compassionate concern for our welfare, knowledge of what that welfare truly is, the stern strength to make us take the nasty medicine when necessary, the power to help and guide us along the narrow way to our spiritual home, the forgiveness and mercy of the Father who welcomes with joy the returning prodigal, the power to bring essential innovations to the human drama which he has himself created, and a love that is equal towards all his human children. These are surely the salient qualities in man's mental image of God. And these qualities, all of them, those who have the eyes to see, have seen in Sai Baba. Furthermore, a tree is judged by its fruit, as the Bible tells us. Baba's fruits are those devotees who have surrendered themselves fully to his influence and through the years been molded thereby. After meeting a number of these, several Western visitors have remarked, "Baba's devotees are a wonderful advertisement to him." After being with them, one knows even without meeting him that Baba is something very special. I myself can say that never before, after years of experience in many places, among many groups of seekers, have I met a set of people with such fraternity, such generosity, such warm-heartedness and sincerity. It is a joy to be among them, and often I think of the words of St. John concerning the early followers of Christ. We love each other because he first loved us. To a Vedantist devotee of Baba, I once said, "Do you think Sai Baba is an avatar?" He replied, "That's really a subject well out of my metaphysical depths. But of his godlike love, power, infinitude, inscrutability, and final mystery, there is no doubt." I find myself echoing this. Why bother about a metaphysical label over which men will argue anyway? There is certainty concerning the divine attributes, and there is, too, the feeling of unfathomable waters. As I once remarked in an address to one of Baba's mammoth audiences, writing a book about him is like trying to enclose the universe in a small room. The point is, put more graphically in a symbolic story. When the child Krishna was running around, getting into all sorts of mischief, his foster mother, Yashoda, tried to tie him to a post with a piece of rope. But the rope would not go around his body. She took a longer piece, but that also proved a little too short. Whatever length she obtained, it was never quite long enough to encircle the divine child. So too, I find that every description of Sai Baba, of his miracles, his personality, his qualities, his teachings, is short of the actuality. There is always something important that eludes and escapes one. On this matter, Baba himself says, "No one can understand by mystery. The best thing you can do is to get immersed in it." There is no use arguing about pros and cons. Dive and know the depth. Eat and know the taste. Then you can discuss me to your heart's content. Develop the truth and love, and then you need not even pray to be granted this and that. Everything will be added unto you unasked. At another time he said, "Of course, you must discard all evil in you before you can evaluate the mystery. Do not proclaim before you are convinced. Be silent while you are still undecided. When faith dawns, fence it around with discipline and self-control so that the tender shoots are guarded against the goats and cattle, the motley crowd of cynics and unbelievers. When your faith grows into a big tree, those very same goats and cattle can lie down in the shade that it will spread."
In the course of all the sessions, we saw Mr. Murfitt evaluate the cause of spirituality, investigate it methodically through the prism of his own skepticism and rationality, highlighting minute details before he decided to plunge into the divine pool himself. From a skeptic who had first come to Baba to see him perform some miracles, to the one who became an integral part of the Sai family, the author's spiritual quest and this book have come a full circle. But there is a greater learning for all of us, and that is beyond the vast description of the various miracles that have been mentioned in this book. The sincere and honest manner in which Mr. Murfitt asked questions and sought their answers and improved his spiritual quotient is a priceless learning for every reader. Like him, we must all ask our own questions, for Baba tells us to test and taste him personally before we accept and embrace his divinity. And that, dear listeners, brings us to the end of this book. We hope you enjoyed listening to this talking book as much as we enjoyed presenting it. Jai Sai Ram. You have been listening to a presentation of excerpts from Mr. Howard Murfitt's book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. This book has been published in 1971 by Frederick Miller Limited in London.